Welcome to episode 183 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This is part two of our two-part talk with Dave Buck about porting from older versions of VisualWorks up to newer versions that we held last week. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning.
One other thing that they have is they have their own custom look policies, and
lots of people do that. Yeah,
yeah. But in this case, when they first developed the system, it was back in the late 90s, and their operating system was OS 2. So now, now their look policy is a subclass of CUA look policy, and that doesn't even exist anymore.
I think it might be an obsolete, but yes, it's either an obsolete or it might even have been yanked from obsolete.
Well, you know, OS 2 is eventually going to replace Windows. So.
Oh, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's clearly the superior environment, yes, yes. No, but when you have a subclass of CUA look policy, then it's hard to bring that over. They want to try the new Windows look policies rather than keeping with the CUA ones. But they want to make sure that it looks nice. So we're going to try it first, and if it works well and looks good with the Windows look policies, they'll keep it. If we have problems, then we have the option of bringing over the CUA look policy and getting that to work. But changes to look policies are very interesting. It just makes a challenge. I think one of the hardest things I ever had to deal with, and I've probably told the story before on this podcast, but during an upgrade, was an upgrade from, I think it was 2.5 up to one of the later versions of 5.4, I believe. And there we had a customer who had stored data in the database using BOS files stored in blobs. And the BOS files were quite huge. They were hundreds of K up to maybe a megabyte of a BOS file containing thousands of objects stored in just one record of the database. The interesting thing is that part of their domain model was computed values, and computed values work by storing blocks. So they actually had blocks stored away in the database along with all the bytecodes for the blocks. Well, between 3.0 and 5, Syncom changed all the bytecodes. The bytecodes were no longer compatible between the two versions. And Syncom's normal answer was, well, just rewrite your BOS files and you'll be okay. We had 10,000 BOS files sitting in the database. And virtually all of them had blobs with blocks stored in them. Some of the blocks didn't have source code in the VisualWorks source. It's not in store because the source might have been taken from an old version and captured at that time. In some cases, it looks like the source code was typed in by hand into a workspace, saved into an object that way, and then stored in the database.
Oh, that's always a whole pile of awesome there when that happens.
Yeah, that was fun. So I had to modify the decompiler so it could decompile blocks on their own and regenerate the source code for every single block that was in the database. I had to scan through the whole database, finding all of these blocks, recompile or regenerate source code, create new methods in the 5i version for each of those blocks, and then put in a translation layer that says, if you see this block being loaded in from BOS, then instead of using this item, call this class with this method name, and it'll give you a new block to return to use in its place. And the BOS mechanism would swap those dynamically as it loaded. And then it would bring up the system and it would all work amazingly.
Well, now that sounds like probably the nastiest problem you've ever run into. When you've been doing some of these upgrades more recently, what are the more common problems people run across? I mean, the boss files in a database is, while that's a difficult problem, it's probably relatively esoteric. What are the common things people run across if they're upgrading from either, you know, a 3.x or 5i.x era application up to 7.x?
The most common problem is changes to base code, where you've changed a method that was in 5i1. You modified it in some way. Now that base code has changed in 7.7 in a completely different way, and you have to merge your change over to the new version. That's very common, and that's something that always concerns us during upgrades. Other things are, there are some, well, immutability we already mentioned causes problems. There are sometimes problems with multi-proc windows, but I don't find that as often as I would expect, but sometimes we see that.
This discussion just reminded me of an upgrade nightmare that I went through in my previous job with Visual Age Smalltalk.
Mm-hmm.
This was interesting. You know, all of our UI layouts were all relative, and everything was kind of nicely configured so that it would fit perfectly and look good. And it took some guys some ridiculous amount of time to achieve this. Then a new version of Visual Age Smalltalk came out, and some of the widgets that were commonly used in all our windows, hundreds and hundreds of windows, had a different sized preferred bounds, and every single window was now out of alignment. And this is one of those, it just occurred to me, this was one of those irreconcilable differences. This is one of those things where, you know, IBM was basically saying to us, no, it's right now. Even though we were totally sure it couldn't have been. I mean, how could it have been wrong all this time? And in the end, instead of opting to go and fix up every single one of those windows, like I was describing before, we just went and changed their changes back.
Yeah. Sometimes it's possible. Sometimes there are just too many changes to change back. And when you want to keep up to date constantly with the newest versions of the system, it's very costly to keep moving those changes back.
Yeah, and actually on the UI front, people sometimes run into interesting problems there. I mean, I have a chatback widget on my blog where people periodically ask me questions, and I had a guy ask me about a porting question. He was taking an older application. He wanted to move it up to the latest version of the product, and his older application had the notebook widget in it. And
yes,
he had been looking at some old screencasts, no, not even screencasts, some of the old example code that was sitting in the examples directory, and he wanted to know how to bring his notebook forward. And I had to break the news to him that, you know, that widget has been obsolete for a very long time now. I think it's in the obsolete directory, but generally speaking, you should either, you know, you can move the old thing from the obsolete directory and have it work, but at the same time, you probably want to work with the tab widget. And at some point in time, I don't know when, but at some point in time, the notebook widget will likely disappear from the obsolete directory, like a lot of things do over time. And then, you know, old code that's using the notebook widget, they'll either have to go through a spelunking expedition to find the code, or just, you know, do a full migration over to the tab widget with no help.
And now, a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. I was once working on an application that required a number of calculations to be performed and automatically updated whenever any of the input variables changed. I decided that the best way to handle it was to create an automatically updating calculation engine. I created objects that could hold values. Then I created objects that could add values from other objects and produce a result. I had other objects that could multiply. I tied the whole thing together with a dependency mechanism. Now, when you dropped a value into one of the inputs, it would automatically calculate the answer. It may have been clever, but it turned into a programming nightmare. I had transformed what would have been 2 or 3 lines of code into 15 to 20 objects. I couldn't easily put in breakpoints or single step. Every time I needed to debug the calculation, I had to pull out a drawing and trace through it. In hindsight, it would have been better to just drop the calculation into a method that I could more easily see and manage. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Yeah, and in fact, the application I'm working on now uses the notebook widget. We've decided that we'll use the obsolete version for now, bring the code over, get it working, and then look at changing from notebooks to tab controls. The other thing we have to worry about is other frameworks. They're using TopLink Smalltalk. Now, that's a whole framework for, database interactions. That's been replaced by Glorp in modern versions. Nobody nowadays writing new applications would ever use TopLink Smalltalk. But they have over 600 TopLink descriptors for describing the mappings from objects to databases. And the effort involved in changing 600 descriptors over to Glorp descriptors would be huge. So we're going to have to move TopLink Smalltalk from version 5.1 up to 7.7.
I hope you have the version that includes all the source code.
We have the source code, but it's not the latest version of TopLink Smalltalk.
That's actually a good thing. The earlier versions were simpler.
Yeah, maybe so. We're using version 2.0. TopLink Smalltalk, I believe, went up to version 4.
Yeah, something like that. We had that migration problem as well. And in the end, we decided not to do it. And our new applications started using Glorp, and our old applications kept using TopLink. And that was just the way it was going to be.
TopLink is less of a concern for me than the other, which is ArborHelp. ArborHelp puts its claws, digs its claws deep into lots of the GUI system of Smalltalk. And we're going to have to move ArborHelp from the older version to the newer version as well. And then, once again, look at ways of replacing it with something else that's supported. But yeah, ArborHelp will be a bigger issue than TopLink Smalltalk.
Right, because that was built for, if I recall, the latest version of ArborHelp was built based on the GUI that was then extant in VisualWorks in either 2.5 or 3. And basically the two were more or less identical from a GUI standpoint. So there have been changes. I mean, a lot of people complain that the GUI in VisualWorks hasn't changed that much. But I mean, really, if you look at the GUI stuff from 3.x and you look at 7.7, while there's still a long way to go as far as improving that UI, there have been fairly significant changes over time. And if you have stuff that's digging its claws in deep to modify the 3.x system, it's pretty difficult to move that forward to 7x.
Yeah, I once had to work with a Digitalk Smalltalk product. This was only a few years ago, using a Tensegrity database. And boy, does Tensegrity put its claws into things. Oh, that was just awful trying to get that to do anything. That wasn't even a migration or an upgrade. They had corruption problems in Tensegrity, and they wanted the corrupted data fixed. But that was just a nightmare trying to deal with Tensegrity on the, 1995 was probably around the era. And there was only one developer who had worked on this particular system, and he died in the late 90s.
Is Silvermark testing suite still around for Smalltalk?
Well, actually, yeah, we just got an upgrade for that for 7.7, actually, from Silvermark.
Right, because I don't want to really badmouth them, because I think what they do is pretty neat, but we decided not to go with their product. For one reason and one reason only, it would mean that we couldn't upgrade our base Smalltalk until they were supporting it. Otherwise, none of our tests would work. Because one of these examples, they put their hooks into everything to do the UI testing.
And you get into a catch-22. They can't release a new version until you release yours. And you can't release a new version until they release theirs.
Yeah, so that's yeah, and we didn't really want to be in that position, so we decided that we would go a different route with our UI testing.
This current client doesn't use they don't have that the automated testing. They don't even use SUnit test at this point, and I've been talking to them about UI testing, and they're quite interested in VW Unit, which I used for another client to drive UI test cases. But yeah, they don't use Silvermark's Test Mentor. One of the other challenges for this organization, like I mentioned, internationalization is a biggie. But with this application, there are some references to NV classes. And in fact, in some applications I've seen, people would actually use some of the NV widgets in their own application. Not this particular project, but in other projects, people have actually used the hierarchical list widgets from NV back before VisualWorks supported hierarchical lists.
Right, and that would have been an old widget that was fully poll-driven because, of course, NV support in VisualWorks dates before events were added to the widgets.
And that was one fear for this upgrade, was are we going to come into this and find that all the widgets are polling-based and not event-based? And at this time, we just can't support polling-based widgets. Fortunately, they had moved to 5i1, and as far as I can see, although there are still methods there for the polling mechanism, all of the widgets do support the events. So I think we're good there. But that's always a worry. If you have to take a widget, which is a custom widget, and then change it from a polling widget to an event-based widget, you're going to be looking at more time.
Not only that, you have to look at fairly old versions of doc, because that was documented a while back. Actually, we talked a little bit about NV in store. You've moved a number of shops now from NV-based repositories on 5X or 3X up to 7 and store. What do you find is the biggest hurdle those people go through from a process standpoint? I mean, you know, as I mentioned, NV and store have very different process models. How do people adapt to that?
With NV, the tendency is to keep an open config map and toss things into the open config map over the whole release of the whole development cycle. There's a shop that I've worked with recently where they just keep one config map open, and they'll create editions of applications and keep those open. And then when they get near the end of the release cycle, then they'll start versioning everything off to package it and, you know, get ready for a final release. But for months and months and months, they would be in a state where they'd have everything open. That's much different in store, where you publish everything and there's no concept of an open edition. The other change, though, is a difference in granularity. In NV, you have granularity from the application or from the config map through applications down to classes, and you have, like, you can view the history or the additions of every class. And in fact, down to a method, you can look at all of the additions that ever existed for this method. In store, you have bundles and packages, and it sort of stops at packages. Now, there are ways of finding out what versions or classes there were, but you can't independently load them. You can't, like, if you make a change to a package, you can, in NV, you can say, I'm going to bring in version 1 of this class, version 2 of that class, and version 3 of this other class. In store, there's no such concept. You have a version of the package, and to know any details about the classes, you have to start doing differences.
Yeah, now you can load individual versions of methods, but yeah, at the class level, I don't think it's easily possible. I mean, there's certainly no tool support for that. You can go ahead and load version, you know, the latest version of a package, and then you can delve into a class and look at all the versions of a particular method, because I've done that fairly frequently, and then decide, you know, I really want the version of the method from 10 releases ago. But you can't load the whole class from 10 releases ago unless you do it by hand. You could maybe... You'd have to browse each individual method and load them one by one.
Right. And you're not actually seeing all versions of the method as you would in NV. NV shows you every single edition ever created of that method.
Right. Everything, basically the entire change set history, if you will, whereas in store you're seeing the snapshots.
You're seeing the published snapshots. Now, usually that doesn't make a huge difference. But every once in a while, it's interesting to go back and see how this method developed over time. But in terms of philosophy, the idea of having a closed config map all the time is usually a big jump for these development shops. The idea of publishing one base bundle is also a big jump for them. I found with most of the projects that I work with that publishing one bundle makes it a whole lot easier than trying to publish lots of different packages within the bundle and then combine it all together. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but
well, you get into kind of an interesting divide between people as to how they think you ought to handle that. There's multiple gradations within this, but there's, roughly speaking, there seem to be two camps as far as using store for version control. There are people who say you ought to have a master bundle with everything in it and use the master bundle to organize what order the packages load in. And then there are other people who will say, no, you should set your prerequisites properly on the packages, and that way you can load any arbitrary package and everything will come in correctly. Now, in the latest version of VisualWorks, with the way the prerequisite tools work, that's a heck of a lot easier to do now than it used to be. It used to be that setting up those prerequisites was very, very painful. There was the compute button got added a number of releases ago, but before that, you had to go through a textual list and just add things by hand.
And the worst part of that is that by default, it doesn't provide you with the version number of the prerequisite. So you don't have to provide the version number. But if you don't, it'll just ask you when it goes to load, what version number do you want to load? Well, if this is something from 3 years ago, I don't know what version number to load. I need to have the version number captured as part of the state of the system 3 years ago.
Now a short interlude for this week's Squeak News with Randall Schwartz.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. Following the successful release of Squeak 4.0, which was the first version of Squeak to be cleaned of all non-open source code, there was enthusiasm to quickly get the next release out of the door. This was driven by concerns that the long and difficult process of relicensing and rewriting meant that many areas of the 4.0 release were a long way behind the current state of Squeak. As a result, there's been a concerted effort to move quickly to release version 4.1, incorporating many bug fixes, thorough test suites, much faster and cleaner code in many areas, the removal of obsolete code, and a much more consistent and clean user interface. It will also feature a much simpler and more robust installation process for new users. The work on preparing for the 4.1 release is now drawing to a close, but more help is still welcome. You can support the work by downloading the latest release candidate and ensuring all the tests are green, contributing fixes for issues marked as critical for 4.1 on bugs.squeak.org or any other fixes you've been hiding up your sleeves, checking that your packages on SqueakSource and SqueakMap install correctly in the new version, checking that the new Windows installation process works on your configuration, and of course, keeping an eye on the Squeak Dev mailing list to ensure that you are not duplicating work. We expect a lot of interest in this new release and want to ensure that we give new users a great first impression of Squeak. If you want to contribute to this work, now's the time.
For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my Smalltalk-related blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Now, to be fair, you can specify versions, but it's difficult. I mean, it's relatively painful to go and specify version by version. And that's why people tend to go with bundles, because you can decide to leave an old version of a package sitting in a bundle. Although, when you republish, it's very easy to accidentally load newer versions of a given package, too.
Yeah. Well, one client that I work with, they work by the prerequisite approach. But I developed for them a tool that would allow them to pick what versions of the prerequisites to use. And it allows them to pick the version names, so they no longer have to type in the prerequisite name, which is what you had to do in VisualWorks up until 7.7. You had to actually type in the name of the prerequisite version. This was a tool that lets you say, oh, here are the versions that are available. Pick which one. That's the one you want. Okay, that's the one I'll use as a prerequisite. And so they were using multiple packages with versioned, like prerequisites with version names, and that was working well for them, but they had a separate tool for it.
Well, defaulting to letting the dialogues pop up to when they prompt, the way the system shifts by default, you decide to load some package or bundle that has, a gazillion prerequisites. Like I did a screencast yesterday where I was showing off handling RSS and ATOM feeds, and the syndication handling bundle prereqs a whole bunch of stuff. And if you don't tell store settings, just load the latest version of that's at least development level or whatever higher, it'll pop up dialogues every few seconds. And the difficulty with this, certainly compared to the way Envy worked, if that's what you're used to, is that with something like Envy, you could go ahead and tell it, go ahead and load my config map, and then I'll go get myself a cup of coffee because it's going to take a while. And when I come back, it'll either be done or it'll tell me I blew up. Whereas with Store, if you go away for that cup of coffee and you haven't specified that you want it to load the latest version, it'll go ahead and, you know, you've gone for your cup of coffee, you come back 10 minutes later, and there's a dialogue waiting for you.
Yeah, well, my concern is less about coffee and more about getting it right.
You see, clearly we differ here, Dave. I think coffee is extremely important.
My concern is if I say, load this version, I want to make sure that all the things it depends on are the right versions as well. And I don't, even if I set the properties to say load the latest development version, I have no assurances that that's the right version that works with this code. So it's very, very dangerous for me to say just automatically load the latest one in development. And especially if I want to go back a few weeks or a few months and load the version that was there, I have no clue what was there at that time. I really do want the system to keep track of what prerequisite versions were being used at what times. And I don't want to be given either a pick list or just choose the latest one, because that's going to be wrong.
Well, if we can rewind for a second back to what Visual Age does with the configuration maps, I think it's, you know, Store doesn't have that. And I don't really, I don't believe the bundles really cut it there.
No, they're half baked.
Well, I you know, you mentioned the open the open configuration map thing as well. That actually has the exact same problem as what you're describing in Store, in that people used to just throw stuff in there. We actually stopped doing that. We built tools that allowed us to we would publish our code and tag the version numbers with the what was it called? There's always a name, you know, an action request or a bug or an issue or whatever, an issue report, or I can't remember what it was exactly, but, you know, it had a unique number associated with it. And then we built a tool that we called the merge tool, that we could put in the issue numbers we wanted to merge in, and it would go and query them from our bug database, get all the parts that were put into that version, and then it would compute for us every single configuration map and application that it had to open and release into, and do it all in one step. And that way we'd do it at the end of the week. So we'd do a whole bunch of work, and then at the end of the week we would merge the whole thing in, and then everybody could load up a fresh configuration map, and we would never have the open configuration map problem. Interestingly enough, we have almost a very similar sort of approach at Syncom, where we publish to an AR number, an action request number, and we merge into our head sometimes at the end of the week, sometimes during the week, and then we have scripts that will load up. Well, some of us have scripts that will load up the whole base version again, but we still don't have a configuration map, so we still miss that ability to rewind back to a specific snapshot.
Right. So if I tell you, oh, I want the version of your build that was in place at the beginning of January, you wouldn't be able to produce that.
Yes, we would.
Only if there was a build from then. I mean, I don't know.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's two kind of philosophies here. What the configuration map philosophy says, I should be able to recreate the development system as it was at this particular time. And then there's the, I think, easier solution, which isn't necessarily what people want, which is to simply take
a
backup.
Image.
Not necessarily even just an image, but you know, okay, we built it. It exists. Let's take a copy of that and put that over there in the archives. Right? You don't necessarily, you know, in the latest versions of Visual Works, we don't publish out the base image with links back to our database even. So, you know, it's not like we're saying the final version is, you know, hard linked to an exact moment in time in our repository. We're even disassociating ourselves from that now. So I don't know. I think and when it comes to configuration maps, you could never deal with external stuff, which was a real problem where I used to work before, because we would have resources that were beyond the Smalltalk, and we wanted to have the same level of snapshot that we could get with configuration maps for everything, and we simply couldn't combine the two systems together easily. So, you know, in the end, we had a combination of two. You know, we had our configuration maps, which was great for the Smalltalk code, but we also had an automated system that would literally take a snapshot of the system as it stands right now, DLL, C code, image resources, sound files, the works, and put that away in an archive server somewhere, and that was it, right? And I kind of I sometimes scratch my head because on the one hand, this backup approach is just so easy, right? It solves the entire problem, and you don't have to think about it anymore. And what's more, no tools were required. Right, I mean, it's just a Unix script somewhere that takes a copy of everything, zips it up, and sends it off to another directory. And then on the other side, you've got a heap of people who are used to configuration maps and think they're the best thing ever, even though they don't solve the whole problem. And they want them. They want them with a vengeance. Right? and I don't know if you can if the backup solution is really all that's required. Or do we really need configuration maps? I don't know anymore. The world gets muddy.
Yeah, let me ask a question on that basis, Dave. Since you've been upgrading people who move from NV and they're using config maps to store, where obviously that doesn't exist, what do most of these people end up doing? You know, if they were using the whole open config map approach, what do they end up using when they're doing store? How do they adapt to that change?
A couple of solutions. In one organization, I know that they've all agreed that they're going to publish the base bundle each time, and basically it's a small shop, so they can just say to their other developers, "Okay, I'm going to publish the bundle and call it this," and other people may have branches off of that, and they'll have to merge their branch into the latest stream. But they have one bundle that contains all of the software. In another case, the company uses separate bundles for each section of the system, and they have one that has prerequisites, and then they have a process where one person does the build by basically accepting change requests from different people, building the appropriate bundle with the right prerequisites, and then doing a build and getting an image back out to people. So you basically adjust within the limits of the tool. And when it comes to NV, we do have that problem of having open config maps that you basically still can't go back 2 months because the config map was open for 6 months. And so you have no idea what the system looked like 2 months ago. I've had some arguments with some people in these development environments about how to manage this development, and I'm saying you should close your config maps off frequently. And they say, no, it's too much trouble because every time we go to add new code, it scratches our applications, and then we have to create additions and release them into config maps, and it's just a lot of work. So,
and it is. No, they're totally right. Yeah.
Yes.
That's why we built our tools to do it for us.
Yeah, and I admit that it's a lot of work, and I have no argument, so it remains with open config maps. So there we stand. But basically, you adjust within the limits of your tools, and you do the best you can. And for every development shop, we have to come up with different processes for people to use for development. We can make recommendations, but we work with the developers, with the clients, to come up with a process that works well for them. In some cases, if they're sharing code with Visual Age, they have to have mechanisms to pull code over from Visual Age to store. And that's part of the process. So we just have to come up with something that works.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably about as good a summary as we can put on this, is that the approaches these shops end up taking tends to vary based on their personality and their approach to development over time. There's not really a cookie cutter answer. It all varies based on how these places approach work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, interestingly enough, the way we deal with this merging of the bundle thing at Syncom, we have a VNC server running, and that's our merged VNC session. If you want to merge stuff, you connect to that, and if no one else is using it, you can merge.
That's it.
And if there are people using it, and it looks like they're sort of, it's left open and nothing's happening, you just jump on IRC and say, who's using the merge? And then someone will go, oh, sorry, I forgot, or, oh, yeah, we're in the middle of that. And then you just wait in line.
So this is using VNC as a semaphore.
Yes.
Cool.
Well,
Well, with that, I think we can wrap this up. Thanks, Dave. I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us about this whole process.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Yep, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll be back sometime.
All right. And now your fans have more than 1 minute of concentrated goodness this week.
There we go. Bonus.
I think that'll be the name of the podcast this week, Concentrated Goodness.
Uh-huh. Very good.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
And now a short break for this week's Small Talk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Small Talk Jobs Report. Our contributor in the EU, Bruce Enel, reports that in Vienna, Austria, Ramstad Interim is looking for a Small Talk programmer who has experience with Oracle, Syncom Object Studio, Seaside, healthcare application knowledge, and knows German. JP Morgan is still looking for Small Talk programmers worldwide. Please check our database if you have a mathematics background or an interest in financial derivatives. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.